This episode is brought to you by Thorn, and I have some incredible news for any of you that are in the military, first responder, or medical professions. In an effort to give back, Thorn is now offering you an ongoing 35% off each and every one of your purchases of their incredible nutritional solutions. Now, Thorn is the official supplement of CrossFit, the UFC, the Mayo Clinic, the Human Performance Project, and multiple special operations organizations. I myself have used them for several years, and that is why I brought them on as a sponsor. Some of my favorite products they have are their Multivitamin Elite, their Whey Protein, the Super EPA, and then most recently, Cinequil. As a firefighter, a stuntman, and a martial artist, I've had my share of brain trauma and sleep deprivation, and Cinequil is their latest brain health supplement. Now, to qualify for the 35% off, go to thorn.com, thorne.com. Click on sign in and then create a new account. You will see the opportunity to register as a first responder or member of military. When you click on that, it will take you through verification with GovX. You'll simply choose a profession, provide one piece of documentation, and then you are verified for life. From that point onwards, you will continue to receive 35% off through Thorn. Now, for those of you who don't qualify, there is still the 10% off using the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, for a one-time purchase. Now, to learn more about Thorn, go to episode 323 of the Behind the Shield podcast with Joel Totoro and Wes Barnett. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show neurosurgeon and the medical director for Transcend, Dr. Richard Vayner. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from his own journey into medicine, the world of neurosurgery, Parkinson's disease, the impact of sleep deprivation on the brain, strokes, and then we dive into the world of hormones, peptides, and the other elements that Transcend provides. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single five-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of well over 1,000 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. And one more side note, my new book, Kinda, the audiobook version is finally out. It literally went out a few hours before the new year. So you can now find that on iTunes and Audible. So with that being said, I introduce to you Dr. Richard Vayner. Enjoy. All right. Well, Dr. B, I want to start by saying two things. Firstly, thank you to Corey, who is definitely my kind of go-to guy in Transcend, an amazing human being. So I want to thank him for kind of making this connection. And secondly, I want to welcome you onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Hey, I appreciate that. Appreciate the opportunity to discuss some of these issues. And yeah, I'm excited to talk to you today. Yeah, Corey's been great at linking us together and giving some of the background of what you've been doing and the things that you discussed previously. And like I said, I'm very thankful to be here with you today.
Brilliant. Well, where on planet Earth are we finding you this afternoon?
Oh boy, I hate to admit it, but I'm in Michigan. I'm just north of Detroit, about an hour. And it's a Arctic land up here nowadays. It's in the 20s and teens, got a fair amount of snow and ice just recently. So not really my cup of tea. I'm from Texas, so I'm used to the hot.
Brilliant.
So I got to survive the next 3 months. So say some prayers for me.
My wife's from she's from Michigan originally, but she moved to North Canton, Ohio, very, very, very young. So similar kind of weather up there. So she enjoys Florida.
Yep. Yep. As does everybody.
So you mentioned Texas. Let's start at the very beginning of your timeline then. So tell me where you were born and give me a little bit background on your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I was born and raised in Houston, Texas. Kind of lower middle class. My I had two sisters growing up. So I was the youngest of the three of us, and kind of southwest part of Houston. Yeah, so born and raised there, high school, went to college at Baylor University, which is just south of Dallas. I got a degree in biology there, and then went back to Houston for my medical school training, which was, good Lord, I'm getting old, but was about 25 years ago. So did medical school down there, University of Texas, and then came up for my actual formal neurosurgery training up in Michigan in the Detroit area, and did 7 years of brain surgery school. And then I've been a practicing board certified neurosurgeon for a lot of years now. And let's see, married, have four kids and four dogs now. I just adopted another one. And so we live a pretty overall busy life.
What about your parents' occupations? Were you surrounded by medicine when you were a young boy, or were they doing some other professions?
Interesting. I was not. My dad became an electrical engineer. He was initially a migrant from Mexico. Came over in his late teen years, was the oldest of eight children, and started working in the garage, you know, mechanic, and was very into education, loved to learn new things. So he first learned English, and then, you know, started building on that, took a passion for electrical things, and got his first an associate's in electrical engineering, and just kind of built on his career over time. So that was my dad, and he has a couple of brothers that eventually came from Mexico and also got engineering degrees, electrical, civil engineering. So it was a lot of engineers, nobody in the medical field, which even from an early age, they would try to sway me to come into the engineering field. It was funny. My dad would be like, hey, come to the office with me this weekend. I'm going to show you some of the schematics that we draw, you know, and how we do electrical grids and all this stuff, which of course I had zero interest in at all. But I was like, sure, Dad, let's go hang out with your dad for the day, have some lunch, whatever. So I go up to the office, and back then they did drafting tables. It was all these room full of tables, and they would sit there literally and draft, hand draw a lot of these things. And my dad had just like the biggest, bulkiest calluses on his elbows from, you know, being there all day long. And I just found it incredibly boring to be sitting behind a desk. I just couldn't do it. So despite their best efforts to try to sway me into an engineering career, that never went anywhere. Never gained any traction. So,
what does your dad tell you about the immigration experience? In some conversations on mainstream television, there's a very negative connotation to immigration. I am an immigrant from England, and so there's so much, I think, gold in these immigration stories. And here you know, your dad comes and becomes an electrical engineer. I became a firefighter, paramedic. So. Mm-hmm. What does he talk about, you know, the experience and the, you know, were there any kind of stumbling blocks early on as he was trying to find his feet in America?
Well, that's a great question. I don't get asked that very often. I would tell you, there's a little bit of, what's the word I should use? You got to be, sometimes it's politically sometimes difficult to talk about because people are very, very passionate on one side of the immigration issue or another. But I, like my father, this country is founded on immigrants. No one has a problem with migration and immigrants. There's some great people in this country. My dad came over dirt poor from a Mexican family to make his family better. And I mean, again, he dropped out of school in seventh or eighth grade, you know, because his dad died at an early age. So he was forced as the oldest child to, you know, work. And he would tell me he would get bananas off the trucks, unload the bananas. He worked as a porter at a hotel, you know, lifting suitcases, things like that, just to make money to help support all of his siblings that were younger, right? So hardworking guy, came over to America, lived the American dream. So he went from that to a son who became a neurosurgeon, right? So just in one generation, look how he's changed our family tree. And I have the most respect for my father and what he did and the hard work and sacrifices. It's, again, just the success story of how migration should work. So he was all about migration. I'm all about immigrants, make the country great. So much that we have to offer. What he was not a fan of, and he was a very, very vocal about it, he didn't pull any punches, was the illegal immigration, you know, because he stood in line. He did everything the right way. He did all the paperwork. It took him years and years and years. I think it was actually in high school before my dad finally got his citizenship card, which I remember him at the time showing it to me, saying, hey, son, look, here's my citizenship card. And I was like, oh, that's nice, Dad. You know, I didn't really I was too, I don't know, immature, maybe it's too young in life to realize what a tremendous deal that was. So that's pretty cool. Like, he did everything the right way. You know, all his siblings that he slowly brought over from Mexico all did things the right way. So he was very, it would make him very angry, I guess, to see that people would hop over illegally, come to the country without doing the things that he did. Cause he was, you know, again, he did things the right way. Obviously he lived a life that was on the straight and narrow, loved his family, loved, you know, his career, always wanted to do things the right way. So to see people cutting line and running through on the illegal side, and he was not a fan of.
Absolutely. My son actually came. Right? Yeah, no, 100%. My son actually came with me to when I became a citizen. So he was at the swearing in ceremony a few years ago. So that was kind of cool. But yeah, I mean, I did the same thing. Obviously, I had to jump through all the hoops and wait years and years. But I also look at the way that we do it. And there obviously are some barriers to entry, especially if you're from a poorer nation. I came from the UK. So, you know, the pound was strong when I was immigrating over here. So, you know, I think there is a happy medium, isn't there, where we can make it easier for certain people to actually get here legally rather than, you know, just opening borders and letting people flood in.
Yeah, correct. Yep, absolutely. Like I said, it's hard to tiptoe around that issue. People are so politically on one side or the other. But like you said, there's a happy medium somewhere where, you know, we can, you know, find ways to make it better and faster and get people here that need to be here that can really contribute to, you know, I mean, every aspect of our lives, you know, and make things for the better. So yeah, I'm definitely pro-migration and pro-immigrant because of my family history.
Beautiful. Yeah, I find the people in the middle are the most censored. The common sense voice standing, looking left and right, going, "What about here? This is a little bit of both of you seems to be."
Yeah, like, wait, the middle? What's that? We can't. No, I have to be way over here. No, I have to be way over here. No,
exactly. Yeah.
Middle is a nice place to be.
It is. I find the most normal people are there, to be honest. But what about sports and exercise? Obviously, you've got into, you know, a profession of health, and then even with Transcend, you're working in the health space too. Were you an athlete when you were younger?
You know, that was my dad. My mom, he met my father from a friend at work. My mom's from Louisiana, Shreveport, Louisiana. And they met and obviously got married and had kids. But she was kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of health. She was always morbidly obese, smoked 2 packs a day, just very sedentary. Growing up, that's what I was exposed to, all her health problems. And I remember as a child, she made me practice giving insulin shots. And, you know, there was packets of sugar, little glucose things in case her blood sugar went too low. So even as a child, I was in elementary school. When she was showing me how to treat her diabetic emergencies, should they happen, you know, but just growing up and seeing, you know, the morbid obesity, you know, a couple hundred pounds overweight, with all the health problems that that entails, you know, the doctor visits, the hospitalizations, you know, I just, even as a young child, I was like, boy, you know, I don't want to be, I don't want, you know, you just see how terrible it is. And even as a child, I recognized I wanted to make sure my life was somewhat healthier. You know what that means as a kid. But I was always able to maintain a healthy weight and, you know, just like a regular kid run around, you know, just doing the regular kid stuff. And then once I got into, you know, high school, I did run some track. You know, I was small. I played 1 year of football and got out before I got killed. Cause you know, even in ninth grade, some of those guys, man, they're full grown men, you know, and I was a 5'4" twig. So I was like, I'm going to get killed playing football. So did one season of that and then to move to the non-contact sports. So doing, you know, just running and training and then going into college, same thing. I was always very mindful of health and again, never smoking. I learned that from an early age, just the terrible, you know, what it looked like to be a smoker and wanted zero part of that. Maintaining a healthy diet, weight. It was always kind of in the back of my mind. You know, my mom, you know, obviously she's my mom and love her. She's, you know, probably the reason I'm a physician today, right? Trying to help her, I think, translated into instilling in me that desire to help people, right? And ultimately I became a physician. So with all that, also there's the things that, you know, I didn't want. So I was always just very mindful. I didn't know when to make sure I never gained a lot of weight, you know, try to stay active, you know, just those basic things. And then I've always tried to maintain that. you know, just again, just to be healthy. And then trying to, you know, as then becoming a physician and then knowing the importance of, again, just basic lifestyle choices, right? With your diet and your exercise routines, whatever that is, trying to instill the importance of that on my patients, as to, you know, how essential these are, to everyday life and, you know, ultimately how your quality of life is going to be.
What about when you start going on the medical route and now you're in medical school? Something I've heard from a lot of my guests who are physicians was the woeful, inadequate amount of education on nutrition, on exercise, on sleep, on all the things that we call the pillars of health now. And I'm hoping, obviously, that's moving forward. But what was your experience when you were in med school specifically?
Well, you know, I don't have any experience because there wasn't any. Like, seriously, hit the nail on the head. I mean, you spend 4 years in med school learning about diseases. Hey, here's a list of 1,000 diseases you got to know about. And here's 10,000 medications to treat those diseases. But, you know, how much preventative medicine did we get in med school? Boy, I would tell you zero, but maybe there's a week in there somewhere. But there is no preventative medicine. There is no, you know, how do you counsel people on diet, exercise, nutrition, metabolism? No, it's like, okay, this person has, you know, Graves' disease in their thyroid. How are you going to treat that? You know, soon to be Dr. Vena. Well, I'm going to give Synthroid, you know, I mean, it's just, that's how it is, you know, identifying diseases and treating the disease, not how do we prevent that altogether? Zero. It's crazy. You know, I think that's changed a little bit, but it's a little bit. Otherwise, I think the sense is there's too much to learn about how to be a physician and how to manage health and how to manage disease, that there's no time to spend on how to prevent disease.
You just mentioned something that I've talked about a lot, and it's funny because my wife is taking thyroid supplements at the moment from Transcend, but she's about to finish 4 years of med school. So, you know, she has been stressed to the max. So I'm sure that once she's taking her final boards in a couple of weeks, and then hopefully everything will settle down. And I'm hoping that we'll be able to, you know, kind of wean her off at that point. As a paramedic, the number of people that I had conversations with that said, well, the reason I'm like this is I have a hypothyroid, you know, and I'm always thinking, well, was that the initial thing, or have you now got hypothyroid because of a result of, you know, your movement, your nutrition, et cetera, et cetera? I know nothing is, you know, black and white, and there are kind of anomalies there. But when we hear about thyroid contributing to weight gain, it's kind of a chicken and egg situation, I'm assuming. But is that usually the thyroid just given up on its own, or are we actually contributing to this hypothyroidism that we see so rampant in the States because of inactivity in our nutrition?
Well, I think it can be both ways. You know, certainly we see, even, you know, at Transcend, when we're doing routine screening blood work for people's symptoms, you'd be surprised how many people we find that are hypothyroid or having like a functional hypothyroidism where, you know, they're having mild symptoms, but their blood work looks, you know, terrible, you know, but they're only having mild symptoms. Okay. So yeah, it's a very common problem. You know, we get the autoimmune ones, like the, you know, the Hashimoto's thyroiditis, very common, you know, Graves' disease, where the body's forming antibodies to different parts of the thyroid gland, and it subsequently burns out their thyroid gland. So they become hypothyroid. They don't have enough thyroid function anymore. So it's pretty, you know, we see that, you know, fairly common. So we have that aspect of it where there's some just inherent reasons why people will get hypothyroid conditions, like as a true medical condition. And along with that, they get the slower metabolism, right? Your thyroid hormone tightly regulates your metabolism. So when you're low, you're not going to have as high a metabolism. Your basal metabolic rate is going to be lower. You're not going to burn as many calories. The weight can slowly creep on. So that's certainly a factor. And then you have the concept of kind of like a chronic stress response. Right, where you have higher cortisol levels, people that don't manage stress, you know, they're not sleeping, their lives are overly busy, overly stressed, you know, their diets are poor, and you have this constant ongoing on-edge stress response where your body will release more cortisol to help manage that stress. That's what cortisol does, right? Helps your body adapt to stressors in your environment. The problem with that is that, you know, the cortisol does great for helping to manage that acute response and that acute inflammation that can come around with that. But it's also a double-edged sword where those high levels of cortisol can really cause immune dysregulation. so causes your thymus gland to kind of change what it's doing in terms of the types of white blood cells, the types of immune cells that it's putting out. And that imbalance or that dysregulation can predispose people to having different, you know, autoimmune conditions and can flare those up. Like, you know, say like psoriasis is, say, for example, which is, you know, an autoimmune, you know, you can't turn on the TV nowadays without seeing one of these immune modulating agents to treat the psoriasis, right? They're on commercials all the time. But, you know, people that have these high stress response, high cortisol levels, you know, people are under stress, that can bring on those psoriasis plaques, right? So there's really is that intricate interplay between, you know, chronic stress, high cortisol levels, immune dysfunction, that, you know, can lead to some of the hormone imbalances that we treat very frequently.
Well, speaking of that, when you were in your residency, you know, we hear historically how insane some of the work weeks are in your profession. What was your experience specifically?
You know, neurosurgery is, I think, you know, one of the more challenging residencies out there, right? You're dealing with, you know, I think overachievers. Neurosurgery is 7 years of residency training after medical school. And it's a pretty brutal 7 years. It's a lot, you know, it's brain surgery, it's spine surgery. It takes a long time to teach people how to be, you know, safe and effective and have good surgical judgment when you're treating, you know, very tender, gentle, intricate areas of the brain. So again, 7 years is a long time. And back when I did residency back in the 90s, and I feel old when I say that, but back in the 90s, you know, that was before they had instituted the 80-hour work week. So, you know, we would literally work 100 hours a week, 110 hours a week in the hospital. Every fortnight, we'd be on call. So we'd be run around the hospital, taking care of all the neurosurgery patients, any new patients that would come through the ER. So, and you'd be up all night, you know, as at a busy trauma center. So literally you come in at 6 a.m., you're there all day, you're awake all night, running around like a monkey, doing all these things, you know, trying to manage, you know, neurosurgery patients, which in general can be very sick, critically ill patients, right? So you're running around all night, and then the next day comes around and it's a full day for you. So you're doing, you know, until the following night, which might be 6 or 8 p.m., you know, and then by the time you're going home, again, you've been up for 36, 38 hours straight with no rest, and you do that every fourth night. So it was pretty brutal. You know, now fortunately things have changed. You know, where now they have you can't work more than 80 hours as a resident. And if you work a 24-hour shift, you have to have, I think it's 8 hours off or something like that. So you can go home and sleep, you know, collect yourself and then come back. So there's work hour restrictions now for residents, which I think is a good thing. You know, I mean, I certainly fall asleep at the wheel driving home when I was a resident. You know, there's residents that have accidents. You know, there's the reason the 80-hour work week came about is because there's a famous case in New York a while back where there's a resident that was way overworked and made a critical mistake and a patient died. So then they started making legislation to limit the work hours, which again, I agree with, you know, and from my personal experience, you know, when you're up that many hours, you feel okay. You know, you think you're okay. And I think that's part of the danger, right? It's like having a few drinks at the bar. You've had three or four beers, like, eh, fine. I just live down the road. I'm fine. You know, when you check your blood alcohol level, actually, no, man, you're not fine. You know, you're 0.09 or you're 0.10, you're drunk. No, you know, and I think that's part of the danger of sleep deprivation is that, you know, you still cognitively might think you're okay, but, you know, driving a car at, you know, 80 miles an hour down the freeway, having been up 38 or 40 hours, you know, it's, you know, in retrospect, you know, I feel kind of lucky that I never had any real major accidents or anything. So, but yeah, it was pretty brutal back then, you know, and that was before we had physician assistants, you know, or nurse practitioners to help with the load. It was all you, you know, in neurosurgery, where there's not a lot of us. So, you know, you were the single resident covering, you know, a hospital with hundreds of patients. You know, it's not like the general surgery teams or the internal medicine teams. They had entire teams there, you know, like the trauma surgery team. They had, you know, 6 or 8 residents there. You know, so they're in the call room, they're playing Xbox, you know, they're catering in Chinese, you know, and then here I am, the lone wolf neurosurgery resident just fighting for survival for the night, you know, and they would feel pity on you sometimes, like, hey man, come on in here for a minute, have some food, you know. So, yeah, so neurosurgery, it's a unique specialty. It was a lot of pain and suffering to get where I am.
Well, it's interesting because it parallels the fire service, you know, especially us that do fire and EMS together. So many of these men and women, I mean, 24 hours, you know, you are awake or completely disrupted sleep, waiting to be awoken, you know, and still waking up three or four times a night, even if you see the bed for, you know, an hour or two. And then you add in, we've got a crisis at the moment, a recruitment crisis. And now you're adding in mandatory overtime. So just like you said, the morning comes, you're about to go home, you get a phone call. Now you're not. Now it's another 24. Now it's a 48 hours without sleep. And you look at neurosurgery and other, you know, medical professions that have these residencies. You look at our police and fire and, you know, especially fire. And it's like, why are the people that are most critical, that we need to be completely on point and be able to think properly, we work them into a ground. But the person that bags your groceries, oh, 40 hours, now you need to go home. You know, it's so backwards.
Yeah. Yeah, the neurosurgery, it's there's just not a lot of, again, there's not a lot of neurosurgeons in the world, right? There's only about 3,000 board certified neurosurgeons in the country. So, you know, just, you know, the amount of new training spots for a new neurosurgery residents every year is, I think, 160, last I looked. So every year we can train 160 new neurosurgery residents. And then you have guys that are retiring, and, you know, so it's barely enough to fill the needs. There's a lot of hospitals that don't have neurosurgeons. If someone comes in with a neurosurgery issue, they have to transfer them out. So there's not enough neurosurgeons to go around. So we're all overworked. You know, all of us are all chronically tired. You know, we're kind of like a band of brothers kind of thing. Like, we all, you know, try to help each other out because we know all of us are woefully, you know, tired and sleep deprived.
Yeah. Maybe just lower the bar. They'll do it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what they do in the fire service. So we just need people 18 in a heartbeat. You'll be fine. There's the brain.
Yep.
Well, what about the folklore I've heard many, many times when it comes to residency? I think this was surgical. I don't know if it was neuroscience specifically, but I think it was like the turn of last century, if I'm not mistaken. There was a famous, you know, surgeon slash professor who was doing, you know, these residencies and staying up for hours and hours and hours and days and days. But then when they actually look back, they realized that he was addicted to cocaine, because obviously it was, you know, not really frowned upon back then. So then you go, okay, well, that wasn't healthy. And I'm sure he probably died, you know, not too long after that. Have you heard that folklore? Because I hear that quite a bit, and it just kind of smacks of that. Just because you've always done it that way doesn't mean it's the right way to do it.
Yeah, I've heard a similar story. Wasn't it like, was it Sigmund Freud? Was that this famous psychologist that was addicted to cocaine?
Yeah, I think he might have been as well. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people were, you know, back then, opium.
Yeah, all kinds it was okay
of
back then.
Yeah.
That was all cool back then. Yeah, it was no problem.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well then, while we're staying on the kind of neuroscience before we progress to hormones, I know one of your areas of specialty is Parkinson's disease. And one of my close friends actually just lost his father to it a couple years ago. And we just did an interview the other day, kind of from a, you know, a carer's perspective, and how heartbreaking it was watching his dad slowly disappear. So what got you into that field of research, and what are some of the, you know, the things to be excited about, hopefully, as far as addressing that issue?
Oh, yeah, great. You know, as a brain surgeon, the functional neurosurgery part, which I'll describe a little more, is some of my most favorite operations to do and patients to take care of. Because what we're doing, basically as an overview, when you're a functional neurosurgeon, you're modulating or trying to change the function of certain parts of the brain. And there's been different ways to do that over the years. But in regards to Parkinson's, when I was, again, training back in the 90s, it was still a relatively new procedure to stimulate different parts of the brain, almost like putting in a heart pacemaker if someone has an arrhythmia, where you get a heart pacemaker to kind of pace the heart in a more normal way. Back in the 90s, it got FDA approval to put a stimulator wire into different parts of the brain to try to make those neurons, those nerve cells, fire and communicate in a more normal way to alleviate some of the symptoms they were having. And in regards to Parkinson's disease, you know, initially they were burning parts of the brain, destroying parts of the brain, which would improve function. But it had a lot of limitations, a lot of side effects when you're destroying a deep part of the brain like that, right? And you could only do one side, couldn't do both, et cetera. There was different problems with that. So when the concept of, you know, let's stimulate a part of the brain in the nucleus, or the subthalamic nucleus deep in the brain, That will change the way the motor circuitry is going in Parkinson's disease. I found it very fascinating and really took a liking to it. Did some extra training time with one of my mentors at a local hospital here. And then once I finished my 7 years of residency training, made sure that I was going to have surgeries for things like Parkinson's disease as part of my practice. So I got a very busy practice doing that. And I love it. It's just very fulfilling because sounds like you've seen and you've talked to people that have had Parkinson's disease or have Parkinson's disease, people that have cared for them. It's just such a debilitating disease, right? And it's progressive, gets worse over time. And their level of, you know, being able to function, their motor function just deteriorates, you know, year by year. And what surgery for Parkinson's does is we implant a pacemaker into that part of the brain that helps them move in a more normal way. So instead of having their tremor, you know, it makes their tremor stop. And instead of having that real rigid muscles you've seen with Parkinson's, they just get real rigid, you know, they're stiff, tight. It can help to make their muscles and joints more loosey-goosey so that they're normal. And that slowness of the movement, the bradykinesia, that's why, you know, the classic picture of someone with Parkinson's is them shuffling down the hallway. You know, there's no arm swing, they're just slowly shuffling. You know, it's that slowness of movement or bradykinesia that also is alleviated. So people can walk normally, they can dance with their partners, you know, they can travel. And it's just extremely rewarding to get people that are markedly debilitated from their Parkinson's and they're taking so much medication to treat the Parkinson's, kind of like most people have seen, like Michael J. Fox, where he's got those extra movements called dyskinesias, where they're all over the place. They can't sit still. You've seen those videos.
Yeah.
But that's a medication side effect. They're taking so much, dopamine type drugs. It gives them those extra movements just to be able to move. So it's either they got all these extra movements or they're frozen. You know, so obviously if you're frozen, you can't function. So they take these high doses of medicines. Anyway, so with the deep brain stimulators, we're putting these electrodes in people's brains. You can drastically reduce the amount of medicines they need. You know, you replace a lot of their medicines with electricity. So you really take people that are debilitated and have lost a lot of function, lost a lot of quality of their life over the course of a few years. And you can restore them, you know, their ability to be independent, their ability to take care of themselves, the ability to enjoy their life by 6 or 8 hours per day of good time that you've given them back. So the most thankful patients in the world, you know, they all send Christmas cards. They all send pictures like, you know, thank you so much, Dr. Vena. I've got my life back. I can do this. So it's highly rewarding surgery. And there's other reasons why we do deep brain stimulation too, this functional neurosurgery, and all are equally rewarding. So again, as a neurosurgeon, it's one of my favorite things to do.
I think I've seen a video on social media of someone having those. And I believe, unless I'm just completely naive and it wasn't what I was seeing, they had the ability to turn it on. So you saw them prior and then they turned it on and they had the tremors and all of a sudden the tremors just stopped. And I forget what he was doing. I think he was trying to drink a glass of water. And before he, you know, he just couldn't even get his hand close to it. And they turned it on and then he picked it up and drank it. It was amazing to watch.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And we do that in the operating tomb because in operating tomb because the patients are awake where we're doing these surgeries, which sounds crazy and barbaric, but you know, wherever we're doing anything painful, they're sedated, and then once they're awake, as we're putting these probes in the brain to kind of map out where these abnormal areas are, and then we put the electrode in and we turn it on. It's a lot of excitement. You know, patients sometimes cry because you know they've had years where they're going like this, right? They can't move. And you hit the light switch and then it stops, right? So now they look at this hand like it's an alien hand, you know, because it's not moving. And, you know, beforehand in pre-op area, you've had them, okay, try to write your name and it's like, you know, or try to drink from a cup of water and it's all over the place. And now you have them in surgery with this electrode in place, you flip it on and now they're able to write clearly. You know, they can bring a cup up to their mouth. It's, you know, if you can see some videos on YouTube where they're, you know, they'll play a violin or, you know, they'll do things like that that are, you know, fun to watch. I think somewhat unnecessary and overly dramatized, but
I'm still waiting for someone to take a drum set in there. That would impress me.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's fun. But, you know, you can have them do simpler things just to show that there's a sudden dramatic change in their symptoms. So it's, yeah. So you've seen the videos. They're out there online. You know, that's something we do in the operating room. You know, it's another day at the office for us. So it's really cool stuff. You know, I love it. I enjoy it.
Beautiful. When it comes to the elements that contribute to someone being more likely to get Parkinson's, I just sat and listened to a class a few months ago, and I think it was a gentleman from the UF here in Florida. And because I've heard people, you know, on the show many times refer to Alzheimer's as type 3 diabetes. So clearly, obviously, there's some nutritional elements that we can address and lower our chances there. But this gentleman, I forget his name, was talking about the contaminants, the pollutants in the atmosphere and foods and that kind of thing being one of the main contributors to the Parkinson's disease. What are you finding on your end?
Well, I think the neurodegenerative conditions that you're seeing, like you're talking about Parkinson's disease and also Alzheimer's disease, yes, there might be some hereditary, maybe some genetic issues and maybe that can predispose you. But I think the environmental things, likewise, still working out what those contributions might be. But I think part of, for me, the most fascinating thing I've heard recently, and maybe you've heard some in your discussions with the other doctors, is the whole idea of mitochondria, which if people remember back to high school science, little mitochondria, little round oval thing, as the powerhouse of the cell, the thing that powers all the energy for each cell in your body. In addition to the neurons, same thing with the brain cells, right? The mitochondria are essential for every cell's function, right? It helps it metabolize, helps it to burn glucose. And in these neurodegenerative conditions like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, we know that loss of mitochondria or dysregulation of metabolism inside that mitochondria can cause the mitochondria can die, and subsequently the cell dies. All right. So there's a lot of fascinating work, looking at, how do you support mitochondrial function to prevent cell death in those critical areas of the brain that are involved in Parkinson's and in Alzheimer's, like in the amygdala, hippocampus, other areas for like memory and function, that how do we support those mitochondria so that you don't get loss of brain cells in something like Alzheimer's. And in the news, if you've noticed lately, there's so much buzz about the GLP-1s, right? These Ozempics and Mounjaros. And there's been a couple interesting studies released this last couple of years where looking at Parkinson's patients, right? Let's keep the Parkinson's theme going, right? So we look at Parkinson's patients, and you have patients that are diagnosed with Parkinson's disease and say, oh, well, there's a certain subsegment of those that also have they're overweight or they have diabetes. So we're going to put them on a GLP-1. Let's put them on semaglutide or tirzepatide, whatever. And when you follow up on those patients a year later, surprisingly, the ones who are on the GLP-1, their Parkinson's disease, their motor function did not progress. Parkinson's disease is a progressive loss of function over many years, right? But the ones that were getting those GLP-1s showed no change in their motor function. That's a pretty big deal, right? And also, there's a study looking at Alzheimer's patients, where when Alzheimer's patients were put on GLP-1 medications, and you look at them a year, 18 months later, their cognitive function, their memory, their ability to function was unchanged compared to the ones who were not, compared to the Alzheimer's patients that were not on GLP-1 medications. So I think it just goes to, what those GLP-1 medications are doing, right? They're very important for how energy is metabolized in the mitochondria, right? Help for glucose metabolism and regulation, keeps your blood sugar stable. So I think that's fascinating that these things are working on that mitochondrial and that cellular level to prevent further cells from dying and stopping things like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease from doing their natural progression that they normally do, that you can stop them with managing their blood sugars or at least helping to regulate that glucose metabolism, with these medications. I think it's fascinating.
Would that suggest then that even without the GLP-1, if someone had gone to a very clean whole food diet that was balanced and got as close to homeostasis, that would have the similar effect?
Well, we know there's certain things that will predispose you to that, right? Like diabetes, the high blood pressure, the high cholesterol and hypertriglycerides. We certainly know that there is things that are associated with a higher risk of getting Alzheimer's disease. Yeah, so those just underlying, like a lot of the diseases that we deal with and cancers we deal with, so much is based on healthy diet choices and lifestyle. Like even like exercise, talking about Alzheimer's, we know that people that maintain a moderate level of exercise can have much less chance of getting Alzheimer's. And in patients who do have early cognitive loss or early Alzheimer's disease, who get maintained in an exercise program, again, they're able to maintain or even regain some of their lost cognitive function. I mean, that just tells you how important exercise is and getting the blood flow to the brain, which increases during exercise, and how important that can be for maintaining healthy brain function and heart function and lung function and circulation and everything else.
Wait, they're all connected?
Wait, imagine that. That's crazy. Yeah, but I didn't learn this in med school. This was not in med school.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I didn't either. This is the thing. Obviously, I've been through a medical route, but it's talking to all these experts in these fields that have kind of slowly created this. I tell people the Venn diagram, you know, where everything intersects. You're like, okay, well, there's obviously a truth, you know, 1,000+ conversations. When it comes to, the things that are detrimental to the brain, with this incredibly important lens that you have, talk to me about the connection between sleep deprivation and neurodegeneration.
Oh, boy. I think as a neurosurgeon, I don't get enough sleep, that's for sure. I frequently operate late into the evening and sometimes overnight. So, I unfortunately can speak for firsthand experience, sleep deprivation how that affects cognition, not only short term, but, can affect you on a long term basis, because sleep is very restorative, right? It's the time when your brain can, the neurons can kind of clear out the toxins from the day. It can help restore and get rid of the oxidative stress that you've had that day. Everything can kind of reset. And again, it's time for your brain to kind of cleanse itself over those hours of sleep so that it's ready for the next day of brain function. And there's been, countless studies looking at, people that don't get adequate amounts of sleep as to how that affects, not just your brain function, but the rest of your body as well, right? If you're tired and you haven't slept all night, you're going to have that brain fog, right? You're going to be mentally fatigued. You're going to be limited in what you can learn or what you can take on, right? But also we know that, sleep deprivation can affect like cortisol levels, right? It can affect hormone levels. When you look at the way it affects cortisol levels, if you have this cortisol, dysregulation because your sleep cycles are off, cortisol can have, although there might be some benefits of cortisol in the short term, there's, having chronically elevated cortisol levels as a, from chronic stress can certainly have some profound impact on the body in negative ways, right? It can be adverse to your heart tissue and, your thyroid gland and, just your immune response and your thymus gland, those high levels of cortisol, which are associated with sleep deprivation. So in terms of cognitive function, you got to get enough sleep. Everybody says, 6 to 8 hours of sleep is what you need. And I'd say, 8 hours is a good goal to shoot for. To make sure that, during that time, your memories can consolidate, your brain can cleanse itself, the cells can reset and stay as healthy as possible.
What about strokes? This is an interesting one. I mean, tragically interesting, but I'm seeing more and more and more strokes in the fire service of young, especially men for some reason. It seems to be, more on the male side. What impact of chronic stress, sleep deprivation, et cetera, how does that create an increased chance of a blood vessel in the brain actually, I'm sort of thinking the word exploding. That's not the word I'm looking for. Yeah, breaching.
Yeah, burst, rupture.
Thank you.
Yeah. And unfortunately, one of the things I have to deal with as a brain surgeon is the strokes that happen, the hemorrhagic strokes when something bursts, and not necessarily an aneurysm, but probably the number one cause that I see as a neurosurgeon is uncontrolled or inadequately controlled even high blood pressure, or people can, they call it the silent killer, right? Because people walk around with a blood pressure of 160, 180, 200. I saw a person in the ER just the other night, 220. And the blood vessels in the brain just aren't designed to carry that kind of pressure, that kind of load, and they will burst. And when you have these bursts in the brain, the blood dissects through the brain tissue and destroys it. And you can have significant neurologic deficits or even die from these strokes. And I think for the younger people that we see, again, it's a lot of things that could be prevented. Just getting routine screenings. No one wants like to go to the doctor. I feel great. Why don't I want to go to the doctor? Right? I'm not having any problems. But you stick their arm in a blood pressure machine, like, oh, did you know your blood pressure is 160 over 110? like, oh, no, I didn't know that. But my mom and dad both have high blood pressure. You know, and it's like, okay, well, I'm glad you got checked out. Let's lose some weight. Let's do these things. Let's recheck it. And if it's not good, you know, maybe they have to go on a blood pressure medicine. So that's probably the number one cause that we see is just uncontrolled blood pressure in the younger folks who are just blissfully unaware that they have this time bomb just waiting to go off. So it's always very sad. Recently saw even a young person, I think she was 42, that died of a massive hemorrhagic stroke. Had no idea that she, her family had no idea she had this high blood pressure. Neither did she. Yeah, it happens. And I think, excuse me, people that are in high stress jobs, you know, the constant adrenaline response, you know, that maybe they're getting, you know, these rises in blood pressure during the day, that maybe they already have a baseline problem. Maybe they're walking around 130, 140, you know, 150. And then they get these high stress jobs where, you know, they're jacked up on adrenaline, running into scenes of whatever, whether it be the fire, EMS, police. And now suddenly your blood pressure is 180, 190 because, you know, you got so much adrenaline pumping through your body. You know, your heart rate's faster, your blood pressure's higher. And that's enough to send you over the edge to have a blood vessel burst in your brain.
You talked about prescribing blood pressure medication. One of the things that I don't see happening in the the regular medical world is you have that patient. You know, they are 50 pounds overweight. They're not very active, and they've got a BP of, you know, like you said, you know, 160 over 110 walking around. I don't see that conversation of, so let's give you this medication for now. We don't want your BP going even higher and being a dangerous point, but we need to have an exit strategy to ultimately get you off it again. The same with psych meds, the same with so many. To me, there seems to be this culture of, well, you're going to be on it forever. It is what it is, which, you know, economically obviously is great for drug companies if you've got a, you know, a user for life. But I don't think ethically that's a very good philosophy to have. And I understand the kind of broken system as far as the minute amount of time a lot of these physicians get with their patients, but I feel like there needs to be a change in ethos. Some of these medications have an application, but not for a lifetime use.
Oh boy. You know, I think a lot of that falls into the time that it takes to educate patients on some of these things, right? Because doctors and, you know, the primary care docs, you know, like I said, God love them. I have a lot of great friends that are family practice docs, internal medicine docs. And yeah, when they have a patient that comes in their office, they have 15 minutes, you know, maybe less than that. And they got to go through their health history, you know, what medicines they're on, what else is going on. And how much of that time is left to say, okay, yeah, your blood pressure is borderline. Let's talk about how we're going to address it. So talking about lifestyle and diet and exercise and programs and what else, what other stress is going on in their life? How's your sleep? You know, how, what are you doing to control stress? You know, all of these things just take time. And it's time that honestly, I don't think that they have or that they're able to spend with patients to do the whole preventative aspect and make an exit plan. It's like, okay, well, yeah, blood pressure is 160. Here's a prescription for ABC medicine, whatever it is. And we'll see you back in 6 weeks to check it. And they come back for their checkup. Oh yeah, your blood pressure is 130. Now you're good. I'll call you in refills every 90 days. Problem solved. You know, meanwhile, they're still 50 pounds overweight. They're still smoking a pack of cigarettes. Their diet sucks. And they haven't exercised since high school. You know, I mean, it's just, you're right. It's broken. And the emphasis is on the wrong things. And sometimes medications, you know, are absolutely needed. You have whatever the kidney issues, heart issues, whatever it is, medications are needed. Absolutely. But I think we miss a lot of the opportunity to change things in a natural way, get people healthier, to come off those medications. They're overall healthier. They don't have the side effects of the medicines. And we miss those opportunities all the time. It's a huge break, I think, in the healthcare delivery that all of us give every day.
There seems to be, and again, correct me if I'm wrong if it's changed now, but there seems to be in a lot of conversations I had almost a kind of poo-pooing of the idea that you could reverse type 2 diabetes or hypertension with diet and exercise. And I think that in itself is in a very, very kind of cancerous way of thinking.
Yeah. I think, you know, sometimes it's also a much easier route to take, right? So, okay, I'm 100 pounds overweight. I'm going to take metformin and we start doing some insulin. I have blood pressure, triglycerides, whatever. Give me medicine. It's no work needed, right? Just give me a medicine to fix it, right? Just doctor, make me better. You know, I think, again, a lot of that comes to the education and trying to partner you know, with the patient and saying, okay, here's what you got. You know, if we can't get this diabetes under control, you know, I mean, I can give you medicine, but there has to be a team approach. Like patients have to do, we have to, you know, make them understand that there's a part that they play in trying to reduce their chances of morbidity and mortality years later, you know, that we gotta figure this out now. Like we have to be a partnership and here's, you know, I'm going to check on you. I'm going to do this. Let's start you on this, but I want you to, let's get you in this at the YMCA or whatever. Let's get you in a gym. Let's start doing some treadmill. Let's, you know, to educate them as to what they can do. That's going to make a difference with these things. Cause it is the easy way out, right? So doctors give me a pill to fix it. You know, well, it's not that easy. As much as you might want to try, you're still not solving the underlying issues that created it. And it's not going to be ideal. It's not going to be optimal.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But yeah, when people say, yeah, you're going to be on it for life. Well, it doesn't have to be, you know, sometimes it is, that sucks. But it doesn't have to be, you know, if someone's sitting there in the office, again, they're 100 pounds overweight saying, oh, well, you know, you're going to have diabetes. Well, not necessarily. How many patients go on GLP-1 medications and they lose the extra weight and their diabetes goes away, right? The hemoglobin A1C gets back to normal. Their blood pressure magically goes down from 160 down to 120. You know, their cholesterol is no longer 300. It's down to 170, you know? So yes, there are fixes to these problems if they would just be addressed and not take the knee jerk easy way out. Like, oh yeah, here's a medicine, you know?
I had a English author, Johan Hari, on the show who just did a book on Ozempic and the other drugs. And, you know, he's a great, great author. And he's obviously putting the pros and then some of the cons as well. But one of the areas that I think has huge application, we're talking about medical intervention. I've lost two friends, or my wife's best friend, and then a guy I went to school with in fire school, to gastric bypass that ultimately, you know, went wrong inside and then they passed away. So wow. To me, even on the more extreme side, you know, the Ozempic style drugs just seem to be so much safer even with that. But you hear this kind of reported that it kind of resets the way they look at food. And then you have the ability to kind of wean off and hopefully carry on that healthy lifestyle.
Yeah. And actually I have a great friend who's a local obesity surgeon. He did obesity surgery for 20 years, you know, doing gastric bypasses and then the bands, you know, different procedures that have come along over the years for weight loss. And as you know, there's such a high failure rate, right, of those operations. And some of them show almost 100% failure rate where, you know, if you don't make appropriate changes to your lifestyle, your, you know, the modifications to your diet, people are going to gain the weight back. Right. So there's a really, really high failure rate of gastric bypass surgeries because you haven't solved the underlying problem with, you know, is the issue with the food, right. The dietary choices, the amount of food, right. The cravings, right. So if you're not solving that, eventually, you know, people will eat, they'll stretch their pouch out, whatever it is. I told you about my mom. She had gastric bypass surgery, didn't lose an ounce of weight, you know, and those aren't, you know, when I was talking to my good friend, like I said, the one who does a weight loss surgery, you know, these are not like you pointed out, they're not benign operations. You know, they're much safer than they were years ago, but you're operating on somebody who's way overweight and their risk of complications from surgery is going to be higher. So there's blood clot risk, there's heart attack risks. And certainly they're, you know, they're always quote, you know, 1% risk of death with those operations. And I was like, yeah, that's probably about right. But when I asked my friend, this obesity surgeon, you know, what do you think about the GLP-1s? And he was super excited about it, you know, because it not only changes the, you know, it helps them lose weight, but it changes the reason that they've gained the weight, right? It changes those cravings, right? They're overeating, you know, they feel full much faster, right? Again, they don't eat as much, you know, so, you know, they eat 1/3 of their hamburger instead of, you know, two hamburgers, you know, so the amount of food they're consuming is way down and their body can metabolize that glucose in a more normal way. So the cravings are gone, they feel fuller, faster, they don't overeat. Like I said, so they'll lose weight and that's, so it changes their whole mind, the way they're approaching food, much safer. Obviously, you're giving yourself an injection. You know, the GLP-1s, they're not without side effects, of course, but, you know, it's much better than a 1% risk of death. You know, you don't have so much, you know, there's a lot of nausea and there can be some vomiting and things you got to work through over time, but certainly a lot safer to do an injection rather than having a major gastric surgery. I think sometimes the issue becomes, okay, now they've lost the 100 pounds or they lost the weight that they needed to lose. Now what? Right? Because there's been concerns that if you just stop your semaglutide, stop your Ozempic, that the weight's going to come back. And to a degree, that's true. There is certainly is a failure rate with stopping those medications because the old habits creep back, right? Oh, I'm starting to crave this again. And, oh, you know, I started eating this crap again and my portions are getting larger. So all these bad habits kind of start to creep back up over the course of the ensuing few weeks or months once you stop it. And that weight will slowly start to gain back. And that's why there's been this recent chatter, which you've probably heard about microdosing GLP-1s, right? You lose the weight, and then rather than just stopping it, okay, well, let's take a really teeny tiny dose. Let's take a little taste of a GLP-1. Maybe we do half of the starting dose, something real small. And will that be enough just to keep away the cravings, you know, just to keep me from overeating? I don't want to lose any more weight, right? I'm done my weight loss. I just don't want to gain it back. So if we can do a little bit of a tiny microdose, maybe that'll help keep me from getting the weight back. So I know a lot of patients are trying that. I've had some success with that. But still to be determined, okay, what is that dose? Is that forever dose? You know, how do we manage microdosing? So I'm sure there'll be more to that to come as the years go by.
Interesting. I want to hit one more topic and then we'll go to Transcend and unpack the whole hormonal discussion. But while we're in the neuroscience side, when I was going, you know, learning science when I was kind of young, again, the 90s, someone referred to that as the 1900s the other day, which really made me sad. The science seemed to say that once brain tissue was damaged, you know, whether it's a stroke or a spinal cord or whatever it was, that was it. Brain doesn't regenerate. And then as we've gone through the years, you start hearing about neurogenesis. And I find that so, so exciting. And I've watched some of my friends that have had strokes, you know, not massive, massive improvements, but improvements. You know, they are getting better slowly. And, you know, will they ever get to full function? Maybe not, but certainly, you know, X percent better than they were before. So talk to me about that side. What was the discussion when you were going through med school? And what has been this revelation that we're seeing of the you know, the spine and the brain to actually somewhat heal itself?
Yeah, you know, same thing we're taught in med school, like you've heard those, the nerve cells, the neurons and the pathways, the nerve fibers have limited regeneration for healing or repair or reconnection. And to a large sense, that's true. This whole idea of neuroplasticity, where a nerve cell can create other connections, you know, with other nerve cells, which is important for brain function and memory and learning, right? So the more connections, the better. And when you have a stroke or a brain injury, those connections, those cells die off, the connections die off. Or in case of a spinal cord injury, you know, if the spinal cord is cut, all that fiber optic cable of the nerve fibers, you know, that's cut. And, you know, it's impossible for those optic, you know, cables to get, you know, start, you know, functioning again. You know, the same thing with the nerve cells, those fibers just don't reconnect. So that's why a lot of people who have spinal cord injuries and paralysis frequently don't get better, right? So just a devastating neurologic injury. So that's how we're trained in med school. And a lot of times that's true. But there has been some work in how to mitigate the damage. How can restore some of that function? And with some of the compounds that are being developed, the so-called nootropics that help the neurons produce more of what's called BDNF, or brain-derived neurotrophic factor, that helps to stimulate nerve cells to regenerate or grow, and also to create more of those connections, kind of restore those connections between other nerve cells, and to help modulate the chemicals that are released between neurons, you know, the neurotransmitters, to help the cells communicate and talk to one another. And with that, will be some return of the nerve function. So there's different compounds that are being developed. There's one that's been recently shown to help spinal cord injured animals, and hopefully humans soon, to restore some of those connections. There's been electrical stimulation to the brain, where they put electrical things on the scalp to help pass electrical currents across the brain to try and help stimulate some of those. Same thing with the spinal cord injuries. There's electrical paddles that we can put in on the area of a spinal cord injury that can stimulate those nerve fibers to try to restore some of the muscle function. So there are some exciting frontiers, if you will, on trying to restore function. You know, Elon Musk has the whole, you know, Neuralink, with which I think seems incredibly fascinating, with the recent one, trying to get people that have been blind to see by, again, putting electrical paddles on the occipital lobe, which is the area of the brain that controls vision, and having that whole interface where people can start to see. So I think, you know, 10 or 20 years from now, I'm excited to see what's available to help, you know, people restore function, you know, following strokes or, you know, spinal cord injuries.
What about stem cells? What are your thoughts on where they will be effective and then maybe some kind of urban legends on where they won't?
Yeah, you know, I think it all boils down again, the brain is in the spinal cord are very unique. You know, it's all about how the fibers connect. And, you know, the stem cells, it's kind of been a bust so far with all the studies that have been done, you know, to try to, you know, restore some of the function with stem cells in the brain or spinal cord. I know there's been experiments, you know, doing intravenous stem cells, different kinds of stem cells, you know, umbilical stem cells or bone marrow stem cells, and giving them in different ways. But so far, none that have gained any FDA approval or acceptance because they just so far haven't worked. Now, that might be great for sticking stem cells in a knee or maybe sticking stem cells in a degenerated disc. You know, maybe there's some utility there. But so far, for the spinal cord and brain, haven't seen too many promising results as of yet.
Yeah, I'm hoping it'll work for the knee. I've got two meniscus that are missing a large part, so I'd love for them to figure out how to make that grow back one day.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice? Mm-hmm.
All right, well, I want to go to Transcend. I came across them when I did the 7X Round the World project with Ryan Parrott. I think was that 2 years ago now? I think it was. Met Brendan and some of the other guys and was blown away by the foundation, you know, the fact of you know, the veteran founder, Ernie, and obviously his story and the why behind it, and saw such an altruistic organization that was doing this particular area the right way, in my opinion, says James. Yeah. What was it, you know, you're this, you know, as you said, you know, one in a very small amount of neurosurgeons on the planet. You could probably align with any company you wanted to. What was it that drew you towards Transcend?
Oh, you know, Ernie, as you've met, is a very dynamic fellow, highly intelligent. You know, when you first meet Ernie, as you know, he's a ex-Marine, very intense guy, you know, big muscular guy, you know, tattoos, you know, so physically he's a very impressive man, right? But when, you know, you spend 5 minutes talking to Ernie, you're like, this guy, he's, you know, coming from the brain surgeon, he's one of the most intelligent guys I think I've ever met. Just a very dynamic personality, full of creative ideas, and has a roadmap of how he wants to get there. So I was very impressed from the first meeting I had with Ernie, and you know, the vision he has and the reasoning behind it. Right? He didn't want to, you know, he didn't want to just start a company. Right? He didn't want to start an HRT business. He wanted to start a way that's going to, you know, transform people's lives and have a place where people can come to get answers to ailments and you know, that they're not getting from their standard, you know, medical community, and make people's lives better. And he had a special slant, you know, through the Transcend Foundation, of helping, you know, his fellow, you know, special forces guys, you know, the armed forces, first responders, firemen, policemen, trying to deal with the special needs and the unique circumstances that they have, and making sure that part of what we're doing can have a focus and help that special that particular group of people that had issues that were just not being addressed by anyone else. So from the very beginning, Ernie had this concept of Transcend, and along with that, Transcend Foundation, from the very early stages of him starting Transcend, because that was his passion to help the first responders.
So this is my perspective. Oh, no, please jump in. Carry on.
Oh, no. Yeah. So again, so that was, you know, that's, you know, you always got to be careful who you hit your wagon to. Right. I mean, I had a love for regenerative medicine and passionate about this area of medicine outside of, you know, neurosurgery and how it was starting to kind of blend with neurosurgery. And Ernie, I knew, was going to allow me to kind of, you know, kind of grow this area and get more of this expertise. And because this is a pretty unique and niche, right, in medicine. This is not, I think Transcend does a remarkable job in trying to get in the latest and greatest and, you know, kind of not the typical standard medical care you get from your doc down the road. So it's great to be on this cutting edge of these latest and greatest things that potentially could help people. So I was very fascinated by it. Ernie had that same personality. It's like, he's just like a man full of creative ideas and things that he wanted to do. And we were lockstep with that from the very beginning.
Well, you mentioned the dock down the road. What's interesting, in the last 8 years of this podcast, I've, again, been educated by all these people, and I've realized that the pendulum was one way and it swung completely the other way. So Kirk Parsley, I had on the show, was really, you know, listening to him on Barbell Shrugged is why I started this podcast. Navy SEAL turned physician, really unpacked. After about a year, he kind of had the penny dropping moment where he realized, oh, this is sleep that's causing my elite warfighters to have, you know, blood results like an 80-year-old woman. And you start hearing about, you know, the range that most of us were subjected to, if they were even testing our testosterone at all. So it was was it 1 or 250 all the way to the 950. And he was saying that in the Northeast, one of the Ivy League schools had studied a town, and the 950 was the high school football player, and the 1 or 250 was the 80-year-old sedentary dude, you know, 2 days from death. And so you've got these 30-year-old first responders going into their annual checkup, and they're like, oh, your T is 3, you're fine. 300, you're fine. You're within normal limits. But they were not within normal limits. Then a few years ago, all of a sudden, these recharge and men's clinics started popping up everywhere. And then I see an absolute epidemic of the same young first responders now, sometimes even without blood tests, being given TRT. And so now it's gone all the way the other way. No one's talking about sleep or changing the shifts or nutrition or strength training and all the holistic things that you want to address first. No one's talking about peptides either. And so now you've got these young first responders. They haven't been told about losing their hair, infertility, you know, the for lack of a better word, the bitch tits. I mean, all the things that come along with, you know, if you're not using it properly. So I see a complete predatory element to this, and my men and women are a lot, you know, more often than not, the ones being preyed upon because they don't know better. That's James Gearing's perspective. What have you seen as far as the hormone supplementation element through your eyes over the last 8-10 years?
You know, it used to be really taboo, right? I mean, you look back further than that, 15 years ago, you know, TRT clinics weren't a thing. You know, it was testosterone. It always had a bad connotation. Oh, you're doing steroids, right? So it was just, it had a bad connotation. Like, nobody would talk about TRT. You never saw advertisements for TRT. And even the doctors, like myself, was trained in med school that testosterone is bad. You know, it'll give you a heart attack. It's going to give you a stroke. Like, state, you know, you can't do any, can't do testosterone. That's how I was trained in med school. Testosterone's bad, right? You know, so if you went to your doc and your level was 300, you know, oh yeah, the normal's 290, you're 300, you're good, man. You know, and if you were 45 and it was 300, but you got the whole talk where like, oh, well, you know, you're getting old, man. This is kind of what happens. You know, you're not 20-year-old, your testosterone 20 anymore. Your testosterone's dipping. That's what happens. You know, this whole concept of, you know, andropause, you know, like women go through menopause when they lose their hormones, and men going through andropause. You know, just a fact of life. You know, you just gotta live with it. But then, you know, more and more data started coming out showing that not only is quality of life can be pretty miserable with low testosterone levels, but also the health disadvantages from having low testosterone levels, right? Where you're higher risk for having high blood pressure, you're higher risk for having diabetes, you're higher risk for having frailty and debility from loss of your muscle tissue. You know, you're higher risk for having high triglycerides and Alzheimer's, you know, with low hormone levels for men and women. So then this, like you said, the pendulum started to swing the other way where it's like, okay, not only are people suffering quality of life with these low testosterone levels, but are also setting them up for failure later in life over the next 10, 20 years, 30 years, because we didn't properly balance their hormones because they were, you know, quote unquote, normal. You know, there's a right way to do it where you're checking the blood work, you're following up clinically, you're following up with patients, you know, making sure that things you want better are getting better and making sure you're avoiding side effects. So you got to be in a place where the doctors are familiar with doing that, the clinics are familiar with doing that. The issue is when people try to, yeah, they go to a clinic, doesn't know, or, you know, they're doing it, getting it from a friend, yeah, my T's low. And, you know, people sometimes have no idea what they're doing. You know, they get on chat rooms and they'll get all kinds of wild advice on what to do. And that's when you start to see the real complications, issues, problems arising from TRT, which should be a safe, you know, thing to do that's important for your overall health. You know, and like at Transcend, we run through the list. Okay, what are you doing? What's your lifestyle like? What's your exercise program like? Tell me about your job. How much stress are you on? How much alcohol are you drinking? Are there things we can modify that may naturally boost your testosterone up all by itself without having to go on any medication whatsoever? So part of what's great about, you know, Transcend, as you've seen, there's wellness specialists, right? They're wellness coaches, almost like a life coach, where you know, they'll do the intake, they'll get to know the person, and they'll go through all these life factors that may be contributing to where they're at. But now that there's clinics that are established and able to do this safely, I think doctors and people, you know, the community nationwide are starting to realize, okay, you know, it's not taboo to talk about my low testosterone. You know, I'm not less of a man because my testosterone is 200. I can actually get help and it's not taboo and I can do it safely. And I'll have a doctor that follows me and, you know, and then once you get on the TRT and people do so well, you know, people talk about it, you know, talking about their buddies. Yeah, man, my test was 300. The doc said I was fine. It wasn't fine. I went to a TRT clinic and I feel amazing. Got my energy back. I'm working out again, losing my dad bod. You know, I feel so much more energy. I'm back in the gym now because I have the energy for it. I can really crank out more sets. I'm more motivated. You know, I'm happier. I'm not, you know, having the brain fog. My libido's back. You know, I'm having sex with my wife again, you know. All these things that just have a, you know, improved quality of life. You know, people talk about it. So just like, you know, so many referrals that I get are just like, you know, a friend or as a brother or something. You know, it's just like, you know, people know to come to a place that, you know, where they can get help.
What was interesting, I was always very mindful during the fire service and I, you know, kept the same body composition through the whole 14 years. You know, I've been an athlete, you know, aware of what I eat. I went through, you know, plant-based for a bit and all kinds of stuff and just, you know, really looking at my blood work each year and going, okay, is this good? Okay, the cholesterol's a little high. Let me take some of the fat out, et cetera, et cetera. I transition out the fire service. And when I get my blood work done, I'm still either at 50 years old, either side of 700. But like you said, it's a number. I still didn't feel like I was, you know, where I needed to be. And I'm not talking about, you know, size. I have no interest whatsoever being bigger than I am, air quotes. But I know, you know, the energy levels that I should have. And I look back and go, well, I did not sleep for 14 years. That would have taken a toll. So I already addressed, you know, the lifestyle things. And so for me, the next step was the peptides. And I take clomiphene, is that right? Yeah. So I had some other ones and I actually tapered down, you know, when we were going through it with my counselor from you guys I was talking to. Initially, it was too much for me and I tapered down and found the perfect thing. So this is the thing. Just because your number in a doctor's office says, you know, whatever, you can, you know, lifestyle is the first thing. And I'm obviously an example of that. You can absolutely elevate it through lifestyle alone. But if you've been on shift for that many years, you know, it's probably taken its toll. Maybe naturally it's supposed to be a little bit higher. So for me, the peptides were the perfect, you know, middle ground. I didn't have to go on TRT, but they were actually just stimulating my body to just make a little bit more, probably what I would have made had I never been a firefighter. So talk to me about the world of peptides.
Yeah, peptides are fascinating. You know, the human body, what is a peptide? It's a definition of a peptide is it's a string of amino acids. You know, people know amino acids that make proteins, but these are short segments of amino acids that have all kinds of ways of different functioning in the human body. And there's tens of thousands of peptides that have been identified in the human body, you know, that have various functions. And we've only scratched the surface. I mean, everybody's heard of insulin, right? Since the 1950s, insulin's a peptide. You know, there's VIP, there's ACTH, there's all kinds of things that are in clinical use at hospitals every day that are peptides. Like, so we're only scratching the surface. I believe there's about 70 or 80 peptides that are in clinical use in the United States out of the thousands, tens of thousands that have been identified. So there's so many peptides out there. And peptides are a great complement to healthcare. And I've just found great utility and success in patients because they can do a lot of things on a more natural way to modulate cell function or tissue function, not radically change it, but you know, help enhance something that a cell is already doing or an organ is already doing. So like you mentioned, like I said, there's peptides for say growth hormone. There's peptides that cause your body to release more of growth hormone out of your pituitary gland. So what does that do? That creates IGF, right? So these peptides do work in a lot of different functions in the body, including, again, tissue repair and regeneration, helps you build muscle, helps you burn fat, helps you sleep, helps sexual function, helps change your lipid profile, your triglycerides, you know. So there's peptides out there that we can use to kind of supplement. I almost like to, people have heard of TRT, testosterone replacement therapy. I like the word PRT, which is, you know, peptide replacement therapy, because these are all peptides that your body makes. But like with a lot of the hormones and things that we have in our body, the levels start to diminish with age, right? Like say testosterone, your levels can drop anywhere from 1-3% per year over the age of 30. So it might not sound like a lot, but you know, you had 5, 10, 15, 20 years, you know, there's a fair amount of men out there that now kind of start to dip into the low testosterone range, right? And peptides are the same way. You know, peptides can start to diminish with age. So a lot of what we do is, again, peptide replacement. We're restoring your normal levels of these peptides that have some very important and integral functions in the human body. So peptides, and you know, they're everywhere now, right? I mean, there's peptides. You see them, they're in skincare products. They're, you know, in shampoos. I mean, there's in vitamin drinks. I mean, there's peptide. So that's an exciting field. And certainly we have many that we use every day to help, you know, people, you know, get better.
Yeah, well, I can attest. One question I have while we're talking about this, I know with TRT, you know, certainly if you're using it for a certain amount of time, there's a reliance on it. The testes are literally atrophying. The body's leaning into the exogenous testosterone now. So that individual is most likely going to have to take that the rest of their life. What about the peptides? Is there an ability to come off them? Or is that something that if you use, the body thinks it's got enough and is actually making less?
Yeah, so like the protocol you mentioned within clomiphene, clomiphene has been around for decades. And what it does, it stimulates your body, your pituitary gland, to release two things. It's one called FSH, follicle-stimulating hormone, and LH, a luteinizing hormone. And one stimulates testosterone production in the testicles, and the other one stimulates sperm production in the testicles. So when you're taking in clomiphene every day, you're getting a high level of that FSH and LH, so you're really sending your testicles into overdrive. So in the fertility clinic side, for guys that have low sperm counts, enclomiphene can help boost the sperm counts up quite a bit, you know, for fertility purposes. But for what we use it for, is to make those testicles make more testosterone. And you can get some pretty robust changes in testosterone levels from enclomiphene. I've seen guys go from 200 to 1500. Of course, that's overshooting the mark. But that's how profound the testicles can respond to enclomiphene to naturally boost your testosterone. It's like whipping a racehorse around the track, and you make the horse run faster. And to answer your question, then with the same analogy, if you come off those medications, like say you do it for 5 years, 10 years, whatever, you decide you want to come off for whatever reason that is, most people don't. But if you decide you want to come off, well, it's okay. Well, if you stop whipping the horse, it's going to go back down to its trot. You know, things are going to slow down, and you're going to drift back down to whatever your natural levels of FSH and LH were. Again, you're no longer whipping the horse. Let's say 10 years passes. Okay, if your testosterone is already low, and then now you advance 10 years, you know, what's going to be 10 years from now? Probably lower. So if you stop your enclomiphene and HCG, okay, well, now you're sticking not only to your old levels, but also probably even worse than your old levels, because now it's 10 years later. And, you know, guys start to feel like crap again. All the low testosterone symptoms come back. So, I mean, you can come off of it, but the reality is, you know, a lot of people choose to stay on just because they get all those symptoms come back and then some, because their testosterone levels sink back down.
I think I responded well, because that's all I take now. And I take Dihexa, which I want to ask you about in a second, and then BPC 157, which I love for the whole joint health thing. But I forget the other two I was on, but it got to the point where my nipples hurt and I cried all the time. And it was either used an estrogen blocker or, you know, that titrate to effect. I was like, or not, you know, obviously, clearly. And so by the time I came down, I think just with the clomiphene, it was still up like 950-ish. So I'm like, this is perfect. I feel good. I can exercise. I can recover. I'm not lifting anything crazy. I'm not superhuman. I haven't put on a bunch of muscle. It's right in that sweet spot. So it's so great to see that something as, you know, as safe and like I said, minimal effective dose as a peptide is the thing a lot of people don't realize is out there as well. And if you are that 30-year-old first responder, that you don't need to go to TRT, because as you said, you know, now if your testes are basically not working anymore, you come off that, you're tanking, aren't you? You're dropping big time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, TRT, sometimes it's, you know, we have people that go on TRT, you know, if they're younger guys, we try the enclomiphene HCG, we do the lifestyle modifications, make sure we've done what we can there. That, you know, some guys just go into early testicular failure. You know, they have, for whatever reason, you know, genetically their testicles just, they stop producing adequate amounts of testosterone. Their brain's trying to force them to make more. They're not. And testosterone is the right way to go. But those are, you know, for the young guys, usually it's the enclomiphene that makes a much better choice, because they're not altering, you know, their testicles. They're not, you know, going to shut down their testicles and their fertility, on TRT. Even those are ways to try to preserve that. You know, the non-testosterone route is always, you know, preferred over for the younger guys, for sure.
I told my wife that it increases sperm count, and my oldest is about to graduate and go to college in the summer. So she's like, okay, you need to stay away from me if I'm even close to being fertile.
Yeah, be careful.
All right. Well, TRT has an application as well. And certainly, you know, I've had a lot of people, either they're older, or, you know, some of our law enforcement, military, you know, some of the TBIs and things that they get that can even anatomically stop production. So talk to me about who would be the right fit. And again, let's kind of take a deep dive into the cautions, the things that you know, might happen as far as, you know, fertility and hair loss and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But also how transcend specifically, how you're able to monitor that, the blood tests that you do to try and get these people at the right levels.
Yeah. Like with anything else, you know, before you start treatment with any, that you're going to, you know, go to the doctor before you start any treatment, it's always taking a thorough history, right? Finding out what's happened in their life, what current medications they're on, lifestyle, what do they do? What's their diet, exercise, you know, cover all the bases, right? So you get to know the patient, so you can meet them where they're at, right? So that's first. We check a lot of blood work, you know, do that thorough evaluation, again, see where people are at, see what's potentially modifiable just based on lifestyle modification. But let's say all directions, you know, symptoms, blood work, everything's lining up. That say, okay, this man who's 40 has testosterone of, you know, 250, feels of all the symptoms of low testosterone, feeling terrible, right? The whole list of low testosterone symptoms, then yeah, he'd be a great candidate for some type of testosterone. And there's different versions of testosterone on the market, right? There's pellets you can have implanted under your skin. There's creams, there's patches, there's the roll-on deodorant thing. You know, there's the ones that dissolve under your tongue. You know, so there's all kinds of formulations of testosterone. My preference and my opinion has always been that the intramuscular injections work the best, because we know you're going to get 100% of your dosage, you know, stuff that you wipe on topically. There's a problem with transference, which means it rubs off onto your spouse or children even. So you got to be real careful with the topical stuff. You know, the pellets, sometimes they can spit out. It's hard to control the dosing with those, you know, it can take some time to get that right. Anyway, so if we decide that whatever formulation of testosterone, with my preference being the injections, if we're going to do testosterone therapy, well, then there's got to be some follow-up, right? We're going to start you on the testosterone to try and get you into that sweet spot of physiologic range. Shoot for maybe the upper third of the range. You want to overshoot because that creates problems. But get you kind of upper third of the range. It's usually a good range to shoot for. Let them, you know, we start for 3 or 4 months doing the testosterone. And then we recheck blood work, follow up with the patient. Say, hey, how you doing? How's the program going? Are we seeing some differences? You know, what differences are you seeing? Are you happy? Are there any side effects? You know, what problems have we caused, if any? You know, and then we check around the blood work. Okay, so look, here's where your testosterone was here. You know, now it is here. You know, we got to follow estrogen levels, because testosterone will be metabolized into estrogen. So it's very common that we'll see estrogen levels rise. Very common. And in and of itself, it's not a problem. Some guys are very sensitive to estrogen levels. And if their estrogen level gets to 50 or 60, they can start to get that nipple sensitivity. You know, the areolas get sensitive. They're, you know, they can get swollen. And if that's not addressed or corrected after many, many months, with high levels of estrogen, then you can get some of the gland in the breast tissue in a man can start to hypertrophy. They start to get glandular hypertrophy in the breast tissue. Like what you called earlier, bitch tits, gynecomastia is the technical term. And that can be a permanent thing if that tissue hypertrophies enough, you know, so then that, the only way to get that out is with surgery. So that's what happens in the long run. Of course, at Transcend, you know, it never happens because we follow patients clinically, like they're followed by the physician and our PAs and they're followed by blood work. Our wellness specialists are checking up. So any of those problems, even at the first suggestion of those kind of problems, we're addressing them. So we've got to follow estrogen levels very closely. There's ways to manage that. Usually it's a matter of a dosing issue. Like you said, with urine clomiphene, overshot the mark, too much testosterone, too much estrogen. And you started having problems. You cut down urine clomiphene and things got better. Same thing if you're doing testosterone injections. Okay, well, maybe 200 is too much for you. Let's drop you down to 180 or 160 milligrams a week. And let's see how you're doing in 3 months. Sometimes it's guys are just so sensitive that they can have, you know, even barely, you know, high range estrogen, still in the normal range, and they're getting the same high estrogen symptoms. And then, you know, we've cut their testosterone dose, still doesn't help. So we'll put them on an estrogen blocker, very judicious, tiny uses of estrogen blockers, because those can have side effects. So there's ways to manage it, but you got to be on top of that stuff. Like I said, following up clinically and blood work. The other issue that's common is there's always a physiological response of your bone marrow to any type of male hormone, any type of androgen, including testosterone, where it stimulates the production of red blood cells. So it's pretty much every patient who gets put on testosterone will have a rise in their hematocrit and hemoglobin, you know, the amount of red blood cells. That's a physiologic response. Your bone marrow pumps out more red blood cells. That's great. You know, so now you have more oxygen carrying capacity. It's great. In and of itself, having a high red blood cell count is not dangerous. So some people think if you're on TRT, because your blood counts are going to go a little bit higher, then I have to donate blood routinely. No, you don't. If you look at the Sherpas and the Himalayas, or you look at Lance Armstrong, you know, the cyclist who was busted for doping, he was using a drug called erythropoietin. What does that do? It stimulates your bone marrow to make more red blood cells. Because if you have those higher blood levels, it means you can carry more oxygen, which means your aerobic capacity is higher, right? So you can't do that. That's cheating. People that live at high altitudes up in the mountains, the Sherpas, they have higher hemoglobins and hematocrits because they need more oxygen carrying capacity. Their body just naturally produces more red blood cells for them so that they have they maintain normal oxygen levels. So sometimes people will get alarmed, you know, patients will get alarmed. We have to educate them that this is a normal response. It's no concern. Sometimes the primary care doctors will see the blood levels and want them to donate blood. And that's fine. If the primary care doctor feels that strongly about it, they can donate blood. Typically, it's not our recommendation. Sometimes people will think, oh, if I have a high blood count, that means I'm going to have a stroke. Well, the problem is it's often confused with other blood disorders like polycythemia vera, or other blood bone marrow problems, where not only are the red blood cells high, but also the platelet counts are high. And it's the platelets that cause the clumping of the blood. So if you have these other conditions that have high red blood cells and high platelets, okay, that's the recipe where, you know, we worry about blood clotting and strokes in the arteries or veins or the brains or the heart attacks. But that's a completely different disorder. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people just kind of confuse the two. So people see, oh, high red blood cell count. Oh my gosh, I'm going to stroke out. It's not the case. Like I said, that's an expected response, you know, from TRT. We monitor it. You know, we watch it. It's extremely rare that someone gets so high that we're like, okay, yeah, maybe you should go donate a unit of blood. I mean, out of the tens of thousands of patients that I've treated, you know, I can count maybe on one hand how many times that's been necessary. So, so we're checking estrogen levels, checking the hemoglobin levels, always keeping an eye on the lipid levels, the triglyceride levels. So the thing, as long as you're being monitored, you get a physician following you, checking blood work intermittently, then it can be done in a safe and reasonable way. You know, this isn't, you know, unfortunately people who are uneducated think, oh, I'm on TRT, I'm taking anabolic steroids. Well, okay. Is testosterone anabolic steroid? I guess, you know, technically sure. But we're doing, you know, physiologic ranges. We're giving you what you had or what you should have as a normal human male, you know, keeping a normal, healthy range. And we're not giving you super massive doses, super physiologic doses to gain, you know, muscle. You're not doing a cycle for a bodybuilding competition. You know, we're talking about, you know, small, reasonable doses to get people feeling good and keep them healthy.
What about our female tactical athletes? You know, obviously we all have most of the same hormones, but you know, when you look at, for example, HRT, it seems to me, and I might be completely naive, but it seems to me it's kind of a one size fits all as well. But every woman is going to be different, so with different hormonal profiles. What are some of the common medication prescriptions that you find amongst the females, you know, whether they're military first responders, that maybe are surpassing what they would get if they went to their GP?
Yeah, you know, in our world, in the HRT world, in this health and wellness realm, women and testosterone is very common. I prescribe a lot of testosterone for women, which I think, you know, a lot of people just say, what, you know, give testosterone to women? And sometimes they're primary care doctors, OB-GYN doctors. I think some of the newer age OB-GYN docs, some of the newer trained doctors understand that testosterone is vital and essential for women just as much as it is for men, and that women make small doses of testosterone as well. In the ovaries, every time they cycle, you know, they make estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone, and their adrenal glands also produce, you know, small amounts of testosterone. So when women have low testosterone, they get the same set of symptoms as men with low testosterone, right? Their energy sucks. They get the brain fog. Their libido is shot. You know, their body, they get body composition changes, you know. So for females, especially the ones that are on birth control pills, right, which is a big percentage, because you're shutting down ovulation, you're shutting down the maturation of the follicles every month so they don't ovulate. Okay, well, you're not going to get the estrogen, progesterone, and which is covered by the birth control pills. But testosterone is like just kind of left out in the cold. Like, you know, that's never addressed. Okay, let's stop you from cycling and stopping you from ovulating as birth control. But what about the poor little testosterone? Like, you know, it's never addressed. And I would tell you, it's not unusual. In fact, we see it all the time. If women get their blood work checked and their testosterone levels are close to zero, if not zero, you know, and then so those birth control pills can have, you know, significant side effects, you know, leading to the low testosterone symptoms, because it wipes out their testosterone too and is never addressed. So for the women that are savvy enough and they understand this, or they look into it, they come to Transcend, get their blood work checked, say, oh yeah, you have no testosterone. So as part of their treatment protocol, you know, if their symptoms are as such, then doing low doses of testosterone for women is great. They do amazing on low doses of testosterone. They're very thankful. Again, libido comes back. They have more energy. Their workouts are more intense. You know, they're sleeping better. There's all these things that come along just like men. But you know, women sometimes are concerned. Oh, I'm gonna get all jacked. Like, you know, I'm gonna get big. You know, no, you're not. You know, we're using, you know, tiny doses just to restore you into a, you know, something that's a good physiologic range. You know, so we're not, you're not there. So no one's going to get masculinized, right? They're not going to grow an Adam's apple, you know? Sometimes women are worried that they're going to, you know, do those things, but in reality, you know, testosterone replacement in women is very common, very successful, and very safe, as long as they're being monitored. So yeah. So the female athletes really appreciate it, because again, they get the same benefits as the men. Their workouts are stronger, intensity is better. They're able to get better results with their lean tissue or, you know, building strength, than when their testosterones are zero.
Now, the other side of the exercise equation, obviously, is injury and inflammation. I have really been blown away by BPC 157. I mean, my poor body. I was a stuntman. I was a firefighter. I was a martial artist. It's been battered the last 50 years. But I've been amazed. I mean, it really absolutely has helped, along with the corrective exercises that I continue to do, you know, parallel to that. So talk to me about that particular peptide.
Yeah, BPC 157, I love it. It's an amazing peptide. I love it. Prescribe a lot of it because it works so well. It's something that was initially found in gastric juice. It's called body protective compound, and it helps the stomach lining and the intestinal lining, protects it from getting broken down by all the digestive enzymes, the acid in your stomach, and the digestive enzymes from your pancreas. So it helps to protect the stomach lining. And then they also found out, as they did research on it, that, hey, this is actually very important for inflammation throughout the body. And it's, you know, BPC is found in every tissue, every cell in your body. So when you replace BPC, either orally or through injection, it has a very potent anti-inflammatory effect, and help, you know, ligaments and tissues heal as well. There's an experiment where they actually cut Achilles' heel and gave BPC 157, and the Achilles' heel was able to completely restore itself. So I was in one of the early experiments with BPC, but it's a very effective. I've used it before. Same thing. I had a really sore shoulder from a lifting injury, and a few weeks of BPC, you know, and it was gone and never came back, you know, whereas before I had that nagging thing and, you know, I would have to take Motrin for weeks, but round of BPC and it's been golden. So speaking from personal experience too, but yeah, it's a great healing, you know, anti-inflammatory, compound. You know, people usually run it for, do it for a few weeks, you know, say 6 weeks or 8 weeks, like you said, like you did, you do the appropriate physical therapy and just, you know, don't re-injure it right away. So BPC is great for those arthritic injuries. We also use it for oral routes too, for some of the inflammatory bowel disease, you know, people having digestive issues, it can work very well as an oral capsule too.
Yeah, I've been taking the oral ones. Is that something that I should cycle off at some point, or is it something you can continue to take?
You know, it's good for the gut microbiome. Like I said, it helps to keep a healthy bacteria and helps reduce the inflammation and, you know, kind of promotes, you know, good healthy immunity in your gut. But most people just would cycle it. You know, they'll do it for, you know, again, a few weeks for an injury and then come off. So probably no need to take a year round.
Okay, beautiful. All right, I want to hit one more of the products and then we'll kind of round out. Dihexa, we're talking obviously about the brain a lot. A lot of people listening are chronically sleep deprived. I mean, I was a martial artist, like I said, so I've had deep sleep deprivation and head trauma, a beautiful, you know, double-edged sword there. So talk to me about that peptide and the different areas that you see an improvement with it.
Yeah, you know, Dihexa, it's a compound. It's kind of falls under the kind of the heading or the category of neurotropics. And there's several that kind of listed under that category, but they're peptides that are have most of their usage or most of their function is in brain cells and the nerve cells. And what Dihexa does, it helps to stimulate the production of that BDNF that I mentioned earlier, that brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which is very important for stimulating or for modulating neurotransmitter release, like the serotonins and the dopamines and norepinephrine, between cells. So it enhances that, enhances that neuroplasticity, which helps development or of connections or the way cells, the nerve cells, will talk to each other. So that's why BDNF is so important, and the Dihexa is directly involved with that. So Dihexa, and I don't say it's like an Adderall. It's not that. It's not a stimulant. But frequently patients will say it's almost like an Adderall-like effect where they can have more focus, more concentration. Personally, when I take it, I feel like I'm funnier. I don't know. But people just they can definitely feel like, you know, they're learning better. They can remember things better. It really just enhances cognition overall. Again, kind of like some of the features that Adderall does, but it's not a stimulant like that. It's not addicting like that. It's a natural occurring peptide that stimulates the nerve cells in that way.
We've covered a host of things. Some of the things that the products that Transcend offers, and you know, the blood tests and all these other areas. Before we close out, are there any other areas or any other elements of Transcend that you want to discuss?
I like Transcend because it's, you know, we as the medical, on the medical side, we're able to offer things that patients can't find anywhere else. You know, I just all day we hear patients saying, you know, I went to my doctor and he said I was fine. Did you get any blood work? No. Any testing done? No. He just said, yeah, this is normal, but I don't feel normal. Something's wrong. You hear that all day long. And I always say, well, you don't know what you don't know. So, you know, you do a full history, you listen to people, you know, you check their blood work. And like, so you'd be surprised how many times we find things like, oh, you know what, let's try doing this and see how that helps. And, you know, how many patients were able to help. You know, we see, I mean, patients come back and back and back and back. And I think that's because we take good care of them on the medical side. Again, they get the follow-up, they get the blood work. They're getting these, these treatments that you just can't find everywhere. So it's a nice, again, it's a nice kind of niche area of medicine where we're able to get patients benefit and help them, you know, make them better. I have a lot of fun with it. Patients do great. Patients very thankful. It's a lot of fun. I think in terms of your people that tune in to listen to your podcast, especially the first responders and, you know, the military crowd, we treat a lot of veterans, treat a lot of first responders, because what, you know, we didn't have a chance to talk about, I know we covered a lot, but we could talk for hours and hours. But it's just in that particular, you know, group of people, you know, with the brain injuries that we see and the PTSD, that we deal with and the people that we treat on the Transcend Foundation side. There's so many things that happen in the brain, you know, not only structurally, but in the chemistry of the brain that's associated with the traumatic brain injuries that people get, you know, on the job, in their training, you know, the explosions, the falls, you know, just the PTSD even in and of itself can cause so much, you know, problems in the brain. Like I said, not only the structure of the brain, but the function of the brain and the hormone imbalances that come from even a single traumatic brain injury. You know, all the veterans that we see that come through the foundation, I mean, they've, you know, they've sometimes gone for years with a whole list of problems, and then no one ever thinks to check the hormones. It's crazy. You know, whereas if you look at the, on the neurosurgeon side, if you look at my neurosurgeon data, there's lots of studies looking at brain injuries in my neurosurgery journals that show even after just a single severe traumatic brain injury, up to 30% of those patients can have growth hormone deficiency later in life, you know, and up to 30 to 50% in some studies will have sex hormone deficiencies or imbalances. So you get people that were spending years in the military, they feel like crap. And, you know, no one checks blood work, or they check their blood work. Oh yeah, you're fine. Your testosterone's 300, you know, in this 35-year-old man, you know, it's just, sometimes it's just, you're just taken back sometimes about how people forget about the hormones, people, you know, about how important these are, and how the brain, is intricately, you know, responsible, for those hormones. And then, you know, with all the concussions and the brain injuries, the encephalopathy, you know, the PTSD, in and of itself, which can cause hormone dysregulations, it just goes undiagnosed and unaddressed. And like I said, I'm glad that I'm in a place like Transcend where there's been so much emphasis on the first responders and you know, Ernie's, the veterans, you know, Ernie's just such a grand job of making sure that we're taking really good care of those folks that seek our help.
I've seen some of the foundation's videos, you know, the testimonials of warfighters, for example, that were pretty much at the end of their rope. And then they actually get their hormones regulated, and all of a sudden they're better again. And not that that's the only thing, of course, there's a psychological element too. But if physiologically you're not functioning properly, which is sadly so many first responders, because of sleep deprivation has just crushed their, you know, their adrenal system and their endocrine system, just getting that to get them on their feet and then have the capacity to go seek counseling or do ayahuasca or whatever their magic toolbox is going to be. But if we're not addressing the simple hormonal balance that can be found out by a simple blood test, a comprehensive blood test, that's absolutely, you know, it should be one of the first things that we do with anyone who's struggling. Is like, well, let's test you first. Let's see what's going on numerically so we can adjust some of those numbers.
Yep. Yeah, it's amazing how often it's unaddressed and people just don't even think to look at it. And otherwise, you're like a fish trying to swim upstream. Yeah, you might make progress, but it's really hard, you know, with the depression and the anxiety and the symptoms of all the hormones that are out of whack. And it has to be a critical part of treating those types of situations, you know, with the PTSD or the, you know, traumatic brain injuries. So it's essential. Otherwise, it's going to be so much harder to efficiently treat those things.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, for people listening, firstly, where can they find Transcend online?
Oh, they have a good Instagram presence, transcendcompany.com, and Transcend on Instagram. They do a nice job with highlighting the services that Transcend has and kind of how we function and what we do on the wellness specialist side and then on the medical team side. You know, we have a big team of physician assistants, nurse practitioners, you know, for Transcend's the first point of contact. They do an amazing job. And then they get to talk to one of the medical providers, you know, we're licensed in all 50 states. And then we get a program going and get people going.
Brilliant. And then what about you personally? Were there any places on social media to find you?
I am on there, and Dr. Vanna, and I'm also on the Transcend site as well.
Brilliant. Well, I want to thank you so much. It's been such an amazing conversation. We could have talked, as you said, we could have talked for hours and hours and hours. I've got 1,000 other questions I wanted to ask you, but I want to be mindful of your time. So I want to thank you so, so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Oh, James, thanks so much for the invitation. Like I said, it's you can tell I have a passion for it, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today.